Welcome to the Armada podcast, where we are focusing in on DAO governance. Let's hop into the show. If you could start with who you are and what you're working on.
Hey, all. I'm Connor Spellacy. I'm working on a lot of different things, I would say, but my focus is primarily around helping to push clear legal guidance for startups in crypto, and then how to understand some of the, I'd say, really important innovations in crypto. So things like DAOs, which I think are incredibly interesting. So maybe a bit of my background and why I got there. I originally started as a lawyer at a big firm in Toronto, what we call Seven Sisters Firm, and I helped start their crypto practice around 4 years ago. And while there, became close with some folks at Polychain and went to work at one of their portfolio companies and also opened Zeppelin at the same time. While at both places, I appreciated, hey, we have a lot of resources for lawyers, but we don't get a lot of legal clarity when we ask these lawyers questions. And the reason is not because they're not good lawyers, it's because there's no clarity available to them. There's not a lot of precedent as it relates to blockchain specifically. So thought we need to start an industry association to start pushing at the policy and regulatory level so these lawyers can actually have something concrete to tell us. And so I reached out to Polychain, and then we heard that folks at Protocol Labs and Hanger were doing the same thing. And pretty quickly we formed the Blockchain Association, which is now the largest industry and lobbying association in crypto. There are some other, you know, really excellent early members as well, including a DCG. And now it's just, I think, 30 plus members, including a ton of great groups, Swap, Compound, Unisquare Ventures, Protocol Labs, the list goes on. And at that point, I got along really well with the folks at Hanger, which is a venture capital firm investing at the intersection of tech and policy. So began working at Hanger, where I remain an advisor. But my focus now is really on DAOs as of late. But then I think one of the reasons we're talking today is around the article I wrote for The Defiant. So that, for that, I interviewed about 35 different folks at crypto companies, typically founders, operators, or GCs, and was most interested in getting their sense of the biggest legal issues in crypto and how we can collectively help overcome those issues. And all the work there was very kindly sponsored by the Interchain Foundation. And then last bit of plug, what I'm working on now is the DAO Research Cooperative. And so the DAO Research Cooperative leverages group buying power to purchase foundational knowledge for DAOs as it relates to some issues that they're all having. So at a very high level, you can think governance, legal, treasury management as three broad areas where DAOs need more knowledge. They need a lot of the same knowledge, and they could really save time and money by trying to get there together and open sourcing that knowledge.
I love it. And this is my Web 2 thinking creeping in here, but would an example of an output of that potentially be something like a SafeNote?
Yes, absolutely. That's a really good example. And I think that would be an incredibly practical output. I think as it relates to the stage we're at with law and crypto at this very moment, it's a little bit difficult to get outputs that are as useful as the SafeNote. So for instance, obviously we have the SAF, we have the SAFD, we have a number of different instruments that crypto companies are using to raise right now. And I think with the SAFE, when the SAFE was drafted, lawyers doing that drafting had a decent sense of how regulators would handle, without knowing 100%, but I think they probably had a decent sense of how regulators would handle the SAFE. Whereas today, I think you'd have a hard time drafting an instrument for investment that you could be 100% certain didn't put you offside securities laws. But that would be ideal if at the end of this, we could produce information that was that practical for DAOs, for instance, to use.
Yeah, that's a great point. And we're at Kraushaus DAO, which is a DAO that we co-founded. We're looking into all the different legal frameworks and how we want to think about taking this to the next level of legitimacy. And I read a really lengthy full analysis of the Wyoming LLC, and I'll put a show note on what article that was. But it was, to your point, it was just so fascinating to be thinking about how many challenges we have at the primitives layer of just what is a DAO? What can it be? What can it not be? Where is the government going to step in? And so what I hear you saying a little bit on the safe note, it's, that's really a, I'm going to say, second order output, which is probably like a ninth order, right? So many things have been figured out in that ecosystem that the safe note was an innovation with all of those things being relatively stable. And so I see your point. It's quite unfair to suggest that a safe note equivalent popping out right now, the DAO space, when we're not even sure what a legally defined DAO might be, at least in the United States, as it relates to security.
Definitely. And I'm actually interesting. One of the things that I was chatting with the ICF about, something that I might help them with down the line, is, and actually something that I don't know that I mentioned in the article, but something that came out of some of the discussions I had with those 35 folks that I interviewed for that article, was around almost like a narrative for new crypto companies as they think through some of the red flags, at the very least, that they may run into along their path. So not necessarily, or certainly not providing with any legal advice. I don't know if you say at the top of the call, this isn't legal advice, this isn't financial advice.
No, but let's explicitly state it now. There's no legal advice or financial advice on this podcast today.
Yeah, the lawyer side of me coming out. But one thing that a lot of them identified was that it would be great to get like a little, it could even be a 3 or 4 page booklet that people would actually read, Medium article, et cetera, that could identify, okay, here are some places where a lot of companies make mistakes. And easy examples are, of course, your raise, your issuance of tokens to employees, the way in which you hire employees. And though we wouldn't necessarily be even able to give really conclusive legal advice on any of those points, you could at least say, at these stages, you should think really critically about what it is that you're going to do, and not just do something like raise because there's a hot market and you think there might be a good opportunity. You should instead really take a minute to think about all the implications of doing that.
I think that's so important, because so many people doing this, inspired by something, and they're working on it, and it's hard enough to make that thing work. And so you have these ideas, you have these suggestions, and it's very difficult right now to know which things are bad practices versus illegal versus a good practice versus a nice to have versus a need to have. And I'm advising one of my friends right now who's founding something in the Web2 space, and they're going through that process of, hey, I'm bringing on an advisor, and what legal document should I use to bring on the advisor? And I was like, have you actually, you're a C-Corp? Yes. But have you actually raised money? No. I'm like, in my opinion, again, no legal advice here, as a founder in the Web2 space, I'm like, send a well-scoped email and say, here's the structure of what we're thinking, when we're doing, please acknowledge that you received that this is within your terms, and use that for now. And then you go solve that with your lawyer once you go raise the money and kind of make that official and make them square. But to them, as they were going through that, the difference between doing something in a, you know, unethical way, unofficial way, a legally risk way, whatever the insert scary variable is, it's so difficult for them to understand, where is that appropriate, where is that inappropriate, where can I bend things, where can I be unofficial and solve those later. And then add in DAOs, add in the SEC coming in with security regulation, it's a very serious kind of challenge, I think, for the DAO space right now.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that the way you recommended to your friend is that seems like what one would expect at an early stage with an early stage company that hasn't raised. And you'd hope, generally speaking, of course, there are intellectual property concerns and a number of others, but you'd hope that you'd have an advisor who's acting in good faith and a company that's acting in good faith, so you don't have to dive immediately into the minutiae of those contracts. So there are good reasons for doing that, but at the same time, it strikes me that what's market isn't necessarily just jumping to that long form agreement, particularly if you don't know the advisor that well at first.
Yeah. And it's so subjective, I think, to your point of like, how many times have you done it? What's your reputation? What's the trust with that person? And what are the right ways to do things? What are the acceptable ways? What are the illegal ways? And I just think there's a very hard understanding of all that. And those are all, you know, lessons learned as you go through the journey. And some of those things I certainly wouldn't advocate for being a casual email, but I think there are other examples where I think it's applicable. But not to go down to the Web2 world too much, but to your point, so the reason I reached out and I wanted to talk is you had this great tweet storm. You were talking to all these different crypto founders and lawyers and operators, and you really did a great job of compiling the thinking into some of the biggest legal issues. And I would just say, we'll put that in the show notes for people to read, because I think it's just it's a great read to hear about. But kind of taking a step back, like, how are you looking at the DAO space in terms of legal? Are you optimistic we'll figure something out here soon? Are part of the challenges, do we have to wait for the SEC to weigh in? Like, how are you thinking about it just broadly at the moment?
Yeah. So with that article and TweetStorm, it wasn't DAO specific, but you definitely have a lot of overlapping issues with DAOs as you do with just like crypto companies generally. As it relates to an answer soon, I don't think so. Like, I would be shocked if we had legal clarity on operating DAOs even in the next 1 or 2 or 3 years. There's obviously progress down certain avenues being made, and the Wyoming DAO being potentially a path organizations could take if they wanted more clearly regulated avenue, but I don't think that's the path that all projects are going to take by any means, for a variety of different reasons. And so I think what will likely be more impactful are actually initiatives like the DeFi Defense Fund, which was an organization that, or sorry, the DeFi Education Fund, which was an organization that was recently funded, I believe it was funded on Uniswap or via Uniswap, a Uniswap proposal. And the intent of that group is to really make sure there are enough resources allocated to working with regulators and policymakers and thinking through advocacy more broadly for purposes of pushing for regulation and policy that allows for innovation in the space and for clarity for founders, so they're not constantly, to your point, looking over their shoulder for regulators coming at them, regulators who they're not even familiar with anything beyond the acronym for that regulator. Like, it's a lot to ask a founder in this space to have a really robust knowledge of regulation around blockchain and crypto, because that's something that's really hard for the lawyers in the space to have, let alone someone who's starting a company in the space and might have more of a technical background. Unfortunately, I think it'll be a long time before we have legal clarity that can make founders in this space comfortable that what they're doing is completely onside regulation. But I'm optimistic that groups like the DeFi Education Fund, the Blockchain Association, Coin Center, and then also the DAO Research Cooperative, to some extent, in a bit of a different direction, can help provide knowledge that can lead to the outcome that I think we all want, which is, okay, how can we build an innovative product that it's going to be useful for the world and for this country, while at the same time not be doing something that's illegal and might cause some significant issues down the line.
Absolutely. And one of the things you outlined as being a input to being able to change this was the increasing the supply of crypto native lawyers. Do you suspect that's accomplishable with the current set of lawyers? And what I'm trying to articulate here is, does it require younger, newer lawyers? I was at a children's birthday party this weekend, and this guy had just gotten to law school. And I was like, dude, you should be a crypto native lawyer. And I was met with, I think, a lot of eye rolling of, what the hell is that? Why would I do that? But to me, if I were on the legal track, my God, that's obviously absolutely I'd be working on. It seems like a massive green space in law. Really? Do you think that there's an opportunity for many existing lawyers to actually turn their attention to this space? Or are we going to have to rely on a new supply of graduates that are starting to focus on that?
That's a great question. If we want answers in the shorter term, I'm afraid that we'll need some existing lawyers to start turning their minds to this, because I think that getting a younger class of lawyers will be the easier thing to do. Potentially, we'll have people, maybe this is a bit of a bias, but who are younger and react less adversely to crypto when they hear about it, might be more interested in being part of the community. I'm seeing slightly more lawyers become interested in the space, and I actually have with a friend's company hire a GC recently, and we got applications from a number of incredibly qualified candidates who actually already did have some blockchain experience. So that was really positive to see, and wasn't exactly what I expected, to be honest. One of the reasons that lawyers are driven into new areas like this, of course, is the potential for business. And I look at some of the lawyers that I work with in the space, and a lot of them are quite young. Like, they can be, maybe they were associates just a couple of years ago, so they're maybe 7 or 9 year lawyers at this point, but they've built up a robust practice around them that probably generates multi-millions of dollars for their firm, which is something that you just can't do really as a young lawyer otherwise. So right. For myself, when I was at a big law firm, I was thinking, I was really like entrepreneurially minded from the outset, which is not really consistent with what big law firms want you to be when you're an associate. They essentially tell you, like, heads down, bill, review these documents, and right, that's your role. Don't waste our time with. Meanwhile, I'm the guy who's just like writing memos on spec to the law firm about like how to diversify their business, how to start up a crowdfunding business. And they were respectful of them, but they never really cared. So I think those are the kind of individuals who you will have drawn into this space, as individuals who want to make their mark. That said, those individuals are often drawn into crypto. So they stop working in private practice, and a lot of the best lawyers in the space go in-house at crypto companies because the lifestyle is just so much better. Yes. And compensation might be better too. So eventually, obviously, the demand for crypto GCs will wane a little bit, and maybe we can keep more in private practice. But maybe long answer to your question, I think both. We need existing lawyers to come in the space who have a lot of years of experience in tax and working with the SEC and employment law, a number of different areas, cooperatives. but then having new kind of fresh minds show up as well will be really key.
Yeah, it's such an interesting macro perspective of legal talent and how the industry, we have some of these treasuries that are massive now. And so, yes, you're probably going to lean towards general counsel, bringing that in-house. And then the private practices are all of a sudden this weird spot where they're undersupplied. But I love the way that you approached working at the firm. My legal understanding, aside from interactions in the Web2 space, is basically Suits and Better Call Saul. So I'm merging some different characters in my head right now that is probably complete unfair to you, but also awesome.
Funny. They actually filmed Suits in the lobby of my building.
Oh.
So it was like fully, yeah, they filmed part of Suits in Toronto and they did it at the office that I worked at in part. So it was really, it was as close to Suits as possible without being in any way related to Suits.
Yeah, there's some association there, absolutely. You mentioned that you are just fascinated with DAOs in general. What are you so excited about with the DAO space right now?
So much. Like, I think at its most basic, it's such an interesting new form of organizational structure that has so many questions to be answered around its operation that I'm drawn almost to the problem of DAOs, while also, of course, seeing the opportunity. But I appreciate, okay, here are so many blind spots that we all have. And my interest almost is saying, hey, let's all step back and identify these blind spots before we go charging in and make this into something that might be really similar to existing corporate precedent or something that's not really founded in anything. Let's be sure we're not making assumptions which are going to get this industry into trouble, particularly with regulators, or are going to set up stakeholders in this space to have the wrong set of incentives. So when I think about DAOs, I think of, wow, this is a beautiful way to coordinate people. I love the space right now because it is so open and so conducive to open source. And it's maybe unique in the development of a new technology in that there's a lot of capital available at this very moment in time. And that capital is in some ways being controlled by individuals who really believe very firmly in open source. And so I think that we have the potential to do something really great in DAOs, but I also see many ways that it could go wrong. And my involvement in the space is driven by the fact that I want to the extent that I can, help us to steer it in the right direction. I'm reading right now a book by Tim Wu called Master Switch. And it spends a lot of time detailing how previous technologies have turned from innovative spaces like AM radio, FM radio, television, etc., and how they go from many different almost hobbyists being involved, much in the same way we've seen the crypto, to monopolies, AT&T essentially taking over everything, NBC, and how these organizations generally operate to make that happen. And I think that there's so much precedent like that to draw from when we think about, okay, how are we going to build the right ecosystem for DAOs? And I'm very excited and hopeful that we have a lot of critical thinkers in the space who are really motivated to not have that outcome, such that we could build something very impactful that doesn't just result in, you know, the existing monopolies in finance and in information technology that we're currently dealing with.
Laud, your attitude towards this, because I feel like you sound like a pragmatic optimist a bit in the space. And I just think that's such a healthy way, because there's obviously a lot of dreamers in the space, and that's a prerequisite. But then I feel like the kind of second, the pragmatists that often bubble up as cynics and saying, here's all the problems and here's why it won't work. And it excites me to listen to you think and talk about that. It reminds me of our really awesome general counsel at my second startup who, we were in a gig economy space. So it was a lot of regulatory concern around independent contractors and W-2s. And he was just incredibly similar spirit in which you were just like, man, there's a lot of problems. And let's start tackling them one by one. Let's figure out creative solutions. Let's be transparent about this process and that process. Coordinate with the local states on these. And it's a very refreshing perspective in law. I'm happy to have you in the broader crypto legal mind space. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's so exciting to be in the DAO world and crypto generally. So I feel really privileged to have learned about it relatively early. And I think to that point, though, in the research that I did for that article I wrote for The Defiant and the Tweetstorm, one thing that came up really frequently was that a lot of crypto companies, instead of spending the time, and I understand why they would do this, but instead of spending the time doing research on things like, okay, we're setting up a DAO. What do we want governance structure to look like? What's the voting threshold for a proposal? How much is the treasury going to be allocated of the total token allocation? They just look to the precedent set by whoever was in front of them or the biggest players in the space, you know, Ally, Uniswap, or Compound, and they just copy it. But they don't know why those organizations did what they did, and they don't know how much time those organizations spent looking into those different models or if those models were appropriate more for different kinds of DeFi products than the one that this organization is offering. And I could see very easily, right, this is almost a zero-day problem where you could build, someone could have built in the wrong incentive mechanism, and in a couple years' time, it could really implode for everyone if we haven't thought about it critically. And there could be corporate raiders who come in and take over, or there could just be any number of players who are able to take advantage of a system that's poorly designed. And I'm not suggesting that any of the DAOs I've listed have systems that are poorly designed, but instead I would just be it would be really unfortunate if we didn't think really critically about every single element that goes into DAO system design.
I think you bring up a good point is, you know, even in Kraushaus, which is a social DAO that we're having fun and our mission is to buy an NBA team. And we're really trying to figure out.
You know, I love that mission.
Yeah, it's a pretty wild one. And we're attracting a lot of smart people to it. But even in a world like that, we're trying to understand what governance structures to set up. And we don't have this massive treasury like some of these massive DeFi projects. And it's already concerning that you're like, okay, if we do this and we do that, if you scale that out over time, like what happens? We had Tracheopteryx, who helped do the governance 2.0 proposal at Yearn. And he talked a lot about how they did a lot of those ideas off chain, not officially implemented in the way that they wanted to, so they could test and experiment with that. But we're in this really strange world where, yes, if you put in that infrastructure that you copied from someone ahead of you, now we have this sort of, like you said, a zero-day risk throughout all of them because we really can't stress test it. I even think about the U.S. political system and our governance and the Constitution, and we've seen it get tested to its brink in the last 10 years especially. Those were issues and situations that the Founding Fathers were really incapable of predicting or understanding. And so you're getting real stress tests, and you really have this almost like bandit optimization algorithm running up, like where we have to test in real life and adapt, but part of the model's intention is to not be particularly adaptable either. So it's a really challenging thing where you really can't set up a clean A/B test to understand what we should or shouldn't be doing. And that, to me, to your point, is super scary because we might all have kind of zero-day risk baked in as we replicate off of what we perceive to be stable and correct solutions.
Yeah. And I really recommend to people who are new to the space and to everyone in the space to question everything still. Because I remember when I came in to crypto, at least started working crypto outside of the legal practice about 3.5 years ago. And it just sounded like governance was done. Like we'd figured governance out and that wasn't even an issue any of us would have to consider anymore. And I don't know why, but that was just the whatever I took from crypto Twitter and others. And of course, we're nowhere near that. There's no system of governance that's 100% perfect, and particularly one around technology as innovative as crypto and the DAO structure. And I think that there are really important precedents to look to. Cooperatives are one, right?
Absolutely.
Cooperatives and the way that they've been built out can help inform us as it relates both to the corporate structure and the history of developing a new corporate structure, but also how people interact with one another. And we can think about the incentives that pushed those developing cooperatives to build them in the way that they built them. And the realities about human nature are probably pretty similar now to when cooperatives started to be formed hundreds of years ago. And we can draw a lot of knowledge from these existing precedents, while at the same time, of course, trying our best not to replicate the same mistakes or issues they had. And we hosted I organized an event called the DAO Summit last week with the Stanford Center for Blockchain Research and the Ethereum Foundation. I was shocked, first of all, by the amount of interest we had. We just put it up on Twitter a week before the event. We had 3,000 people watch live, which is a good sign for DAOs and that there are a lot of builders out there. But one of the presentations was by a friend of mine named Jonathan Doden. He's a professor at Stanford and a fellow at Stanford Center for Blockchain Research. And his presentation was really on cooperatives and looking at legacy systems and applying them going forward. I think it's a really important perspective to take if we're going to build something that's going to last and going to live up to the expectations that the dreamers really have for DAOs right now.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's part of my fascination with governance 2.0 broadly. And I've had a lot of guests who are thinking in that kind of next order of evolution of moving beyond just simple direct democracies of token holders and saying, like, how do we take some of the things that we've learned? And it's funny, though, because it's truly a paradox, right? Like, one of the things you said, suggested was like, hey, question everything, reassess everything, go back to first principles. And at the same token, we also need to learn from the past to be able to figure out. And so it's a really interesting challenge between how do you apply first principle thinking to systems that we also are analyzing and trying to understand what works and what doesn't work, and then applying that to your particular project, right? Which might be so uniquely different that you might just have a different situation to solve for. To your point, it is a challenging, and I think it'll probably be a forever problem, I suspect. We'll probably get to a stability point, a Nash equilibrium of sorts for us to say, hey, we feel like we have governance, but there's probably going to be a lot of false illusions along the way as we get to that. And that might be many, even decades, maybe hundreds of years away, assuming that DAOs achieve their vision. But what a complex problem that is ever changing.
Yeah, which is what makes it so exciting. And why everyone should work in.
So before we forget, I wanted to ask you, who would be your fictional character dinner companion of choice?
Ooh, that is a great question. Just given COVID and the amount of TV I've watched in the last like year or so with my girlfriend, it would very likely be someone from Succession, just because I found that show so amazing and so engaging. And it was like my girlfriend and I, it was our absolute favorite show. So it's something that immediately comes to mind is Logan from Succession, essentially like a fictional Trump, to get a sense of how the mind of someone like that works. I don't know that the conversation would be great, but maybe what you could glean from your interaction with them would be particularly interesting.
So that show's on HBO. And so I'm assuming you recommend it as a great show.
I do. And it's not like Logan is not a personality type that I would necessarily be supportive of, but I'm certainly not supportive of Trump in any way. But it's almost in reflecting on what drew me and so many people to that show was maybe its parallels with reality and the ways in which this fictional family and their insane life probably are not too far from the truth from what families like maybe the Murdochs experience on a day-to-day basis.
Wow. I'll have to put that on the list. One of the common guest dinner companions that have been brought up is characters from West Wing. And that's next up in my watching list. But I'll put Succession behind that as I move through. But
what's maybe not that I've watched West Wing maybe more than I've said, maybe a connection there, though, is appreciating how the system works in part.
Yes.
Right. Like in reflecting on how government interacts, like how lobbyists and regulators interact, what their incentives are, lobbyists fit into all of this, how industry associations fit into all of this, how private enterprises fit into this. What's really interesting about the show Succession and keeps it very engaging is it presents to you what is probably relatively close to reality when it comes to the ways in which people who are in power interact with other people who are in power in different branches of power. So there's a relationship that Logan, for instance, in the show, the Rupert Murdoch type character, has with the president of the United States. And you could imagine that the strings that he's able to pull are probably not totally dissimilar from the strings that other wealthy folk have been able to pull in the past.
Absolutely. Appreciate you for being on the show. And if you can remind people where to find you.
Yeah, on Twitter is the best spot at C_Spellacy. A tough last name spelling there, but all the best in finding me. I'm on crypto quite a bit in like the DAO Twitter circles, so I should probably not be too hard to locate.
And we'll put you in the show notes too for anyone trying to figure out how to spell a C. I'm sure you've heard that pun a million times, but you got one more today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks again.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Armada podcast. We would greatly appreciate a review in your favorite podcast player. And if you want to stay in the loop even further, head to armada.fm, where we have a repo. You can check out what we're doing and what we're learning along the way. Love to see you there. Thank you.